coming on the Jubilee. Together on the run, have a lot of fun, singing in the sun. Jubilee, coming on the Jubilee. Listen to the band, swinging through the land, everybody stand.
You know what I really like about that story and the other stories you've done with, in terms of illustrated fiction, is that you hand letter everything.
Yeah, I got to find a way around that. I'll tell you, the 78 page one. I'll tell you, my hand is feeling it. In this book I'm doing with my brothers, actually, I use type in the story that my youngest brother did and I illustrated, but that was a major pain in the ass in its own way. So that the ones I'm doing, yes, I still am hand lettering them for the time being, although I'll tell you, if I decide to do a whole novel, which I'm now seriously thinking about, I think maybe that's the time to get some kind of a computer program that I could, you know, do this with. My hand, man, you know, I've been sitting there all day, you know, I'll save up about 12 pages to letter all at once, and my God, that is, with a rapidograph, that's murder on your hand. Yeah.
My friend, I'm going to name drop here, who actually did a piece for one of his magazines, Cinema Sewer, Robin Bougie, he does everything by hand, and I think for some stuff, someone actually made him a font.
Yeah, you know, like, John Kuramoto made me a font for The Ship That Never Came In, but it's all in caps. And, I don't know if I'm going to go that way or not, you know?
It sure looks great. It's so personal looking. I really love it.
Well, that's interesting. I'm interested to hear you say that. Mm-hmm. You know, like, so far it seems to be the best way to just really tightly marry the stuff together with the precision that I want to do it in right now. And so until I figure out something better, that's what's happening. Like, I'm on page 61 and 62 of a 78-pager.
Wow.
You know, it sounds more impressive than it is because, it's illustrated fiction. It eats up pages faster than if you're doing a strip.
But the great thing about illustrated fiction is a couple things. Like, you can really control the pace and the flow of the reader, and you can borrow the techniques that I see the one of the books you have in one of your strips, drawing from the left side of the brain.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, yeah. What's sort of interesting about it is, like, all pages are not created equal with bells on here, because, you know, like, some pages I'll actually take a couple of hours. Just, you know, it'll be a page with a lot of writing and one picture, and it takes a couple of hours. The pages I'm working on now, I've been on them, just these two pages for 2 weeks. But hey, they're going to be something when you hit these two pages. It's like suddenly, you're at this bottle cap collecting convention, and you turn the page, and there it is, the whole damn convention. You know.
It'll be one of your big spreads.
Yeah, like, you know, yeah, it's like, yeah, but this one, I think this one will be a particularly memorable one. I mean, I think, I love these pictures where there's a million things going on. I think, you know, where that comes from, when I was a kid, my father gave me this book called The Possum That Didn't by Frank Tashlin. You know, the guy that directed a lot of Martin and Lewis movies and made a lot of Porky Pig cartoons. He also did kids' books. And he used to have these panels, you know, where there's just all this stuff going on. And I, you know, so even before I could read, I just used to sit there and look at that book and look at those pictures, you know, over and over. That's, you know, that's the thing, you know. I think I was reading books before I could read. You know, there was just a whole clutch of books my parents had. That was one of them, but there was a lot of other ones besides. You know, I just look at them all the time. You know, so I was like, my little formative brain was filled with the stuff. You know, before I even really knew who I was or what I was doing.
Getting back to this book, what it's with your brother Simon and your brother Seth, and what's it called?
Well, I'm calling it Deitch's Pictorama. You know, I wanted a title, you know, like the old EC Pictofiction, or, you know, the Fantagraphics thing had a thing called Pictopia for a while. In fact, I even sniffed around and to see whether maybe I could have the title Pictopia, but nobody seemed to be picking up on that, so I just sort of came up with my own alternate riff on the same kind of a title.
It's got a ring to it.
A kid show called Wonderama, you know, it's just, I don't know. Boy, I was more than a year trying to think of what title to call it. I figured I'll get Simon to do it. He gets good ideas. I'll just wait till he comes up with something good. But he wasn't coming up with anything good. So finally, I just decided, well, I guess I'll name it, and that's what I came up with.
Now, Simon, you've collaborated a lot on strips.
Yeah.
And Seth, kind of, I know you illustrated the piece in the Ragtime Ephemerist.
Yeah, that was our first time out together.
Oh, wow.
And, one of the things in Deitch's Pictorama, I did a whole 31-page illustration job on a story he did about a guy who is working in a lab on the night shift, and he's obsessed with the writings of Johnson McCulley, the creator of Zorro, and somehow the experimental rats in the lab are piping into this Zorro story, and they end up making this jerry-built airplane and trying to escape from the animal lab. It's a pretty snappy story. I mean, the first time he showed it to me, I thought it was good. It was definitely one of a handful of stories of his that was really making me think, this boy's turning a corner here. And so when I came up with this idea, look, guys, let's see what we can do. Maybe we can exploit my smidgen of fame here and get us, you know, get everybody off the ground. And so he said, well, how about that one? I said, yeah, how about that one? So,
well, Seth is also... Seth is also Ahmed Fishmonger in the Church of the Subgenius, right?
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
his...
I don't know if he's still using that moniker, but he was definitely Ahmed Fishmonger in the Subgenius, yes.
I remember reading his name when I was younger. I'd see... I'd have the Book of the Subgenius and seeing the name Ahmed Fishmonger, and I thought it was one of the greatest names ever. So.
Oh, I'll tell him you said that.
Yeah. And he also has an Institute for Parallel Studies?
Yeah, he's... That's him.
Great.
That's the one.
He seems to be such an intriguing figure, and even after, you know, reading the name Ahmed Fishmonger all these years later, he still seems like such a mysterious character.
Yeah, he's got a great mind, you know. I'd love to see him get somewhere, you know. I think the guy is brilliant. I think, you know, yeah, the guy, he's a brilliant guy, and... if I can help promote him, I hope I can do it. I mean, you know, at some point, who knows, you know, I wouldn't mind doing a longer project with him. I don't know, you know, on the other hand, working with these guys, I don't know how long we'll last, you know. It isn't like me and my two brothers are great pals or anything. You know, I admire their work, but we're not that close otherwise.
Are you the intermediary? Is that what you mean, or?
No, I'm the oldest one, and you know.
I didn't mean the middle one, but the go-between guy.
I just don't have a lot to do with them.
Hmm.
Seth lives in Massachusetts. Simon's over in White Plains. Me and Simon at one point were best friends, but we've had major falling outs at different times. You know, we're not really pals. I don't really like Simon that much, but I do like his work.
Wow.
Would he be the brother in reference at the beginning of the story did for Zero Zero? The what was it called? I have it written down here. It's Search of Smilin' Ed.
Yep, that's the one. And yeah, you know, and actually, there's another. I want to do another story with him. I don't know if it would be for Deitch's Pictorama, or I'd just like to find another venue for it. But there's a story that happened in his life where, at a certain point, Jerry Siegel, the creator of Superman, he got in touch with Gary Arlington and told him, he said, you know what, I've been reading this underground comic stuff, and I want to join you guys. And so Gary decided to bankroll Simon a trip to Los Angeles to visit Jerry Siegel. And for weird reasons, I still don't quite understand, Simon went down there, but he went down there as Gary Arlington. And that encounter with Jerry Siegel at that particular moment in time, it's a great yarn. You know, it's as good as when he met the Pope. And, you know, I don't know if I'm going to end up collaborating with him or not, but I just figure what I bring to the table is that, you know, I'm the enabler, you know, and whereas he's got the idea, I got the drive, you know, and maybe I could be, you know, sort of the dynamo that could actually have that story happen, you know, if it meant that I just took the subservient task of inking the thing and kind of pulling it into shape. Well, then that's what I'd do if it ended up that there was more for me to do, or I actually took a more active hand in the drawing. Well, that's fine, too. Actually, I'm going to go over to White Plains to see him, I don't know, not this weekend, but maybe the weekend after next, and that's one of the things I want to talk to him about. You know what it is I just read that book, Men of Tomorrow, you know, the one?
That's
basically,
that's
it's how the Jews created the comic book industry. And, you know, the leitmotif that's running through the entire book is basically it's the Siegel and Schuster story, how they made a bad deal and everything that happened to them after that, interspersed with the general history of the comic book. And I'm reading that and I'm going, you know, the guy that wrote this book knew that story would be in this book.
I got to know this story.
Pardon me?
Oh, I want to know this story.
Yeah, well, you know, you'll get your chance. I mean, I want to say much more about it than that, because it's really, it's in the end, it's Simon Deitch's property, and it's for him to, you know, pass on what happens. But, you know, I'm eager enough. Even though we don't get along that well, you know, like I say, I, you know, we don't get along very well. Our relationship is contentious, but I really admire him as a, you know, I think he's brilliant. He's definitely been a major influence on me, and you know, that part of him I deeply respect. You know, he's a flawed personality, but. Hey, he's still here, which in itself is a testament to the strong Russian-Jewish genes we have on my father's side of the family, more than anything else. But and I'm not, you know, believe me, I'm not saying a thing about him here that I wouldn't say to his face.
Okay.
And I'm pulling my punches too.
Oh.
You know, like I say, I'm not really into. I'm not gonna do the dirty laundry in front of you guys on the radio. But, you know, I think it's worth pointing out, you know, the sort of relationship that I have with these guys. It's sort of part of the story.
Well, as long as you guys can keep collaborating. I mean, you had another writer that you worked with quite extensively, Fulton Means, that seems to have dropped off the face of the earth. What happened to him?
He's somewhere inside of the earth now.
So he dropped inside of the earth.
You know, is he dead, or is he perhaps?
I thought he's working with the little aliens.
Yeah, you know, it's an open question just where Fulton Means is. It's, you know, it's one of those anomalies that at some point I hope to revisit and just, you know, dish out further.
Because he wrote a lot of your stories.
You know, what is it? You know, what Fulton Means is, you know, I've never been any good at maintaining these fictions beyond what they are when I'm creating the fiction is...
Don't shatter myths here, please. Don't shatter any myths.
Okay.
Robert's crying a little now.
All right. I'll stop right there.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead. It's okay.
No, what it is Spain used to sign his work, written by Algernon Backwash, drawn by Spain, and I love that he's got this nom de plume. I want a nom de plume, too. And, it just came to me. I was doing this story, The Brandelstein Apparition, which was back in the days when I was still making them up as I went along, and I'm sitting there drawing that page one, and after I did the logo, my hand just wrote by Fulton me. Those were also the days when I was smoking dope all the time when I was drawing the comics. So a lot of stuff like that happened in those comics, owing to that, I used to think that I couldn't do comics unless I was high.
Now, was this in San Francisco?
Yeah, it was.
When did you move to San Francisco?
I moved to San Francisco at the end of 1969. It was like that was what was happening. All of a sudden, it really seemed like, that this underground newspaper thing was dying, essentially because of the sex papers. I mean, a major piece of the constituency of, where the money was in advertising in the underground press was all the sex ads. And then suddenly there were these papers that were nothing but sex, and so were drawing off the advertising and so slowly killing the underground press. And in the meantime, something clearly was happening with comic books, and we were hearing all about that. I mean, in 68, Crumb came to town, and he was beating the drum about what was going on in San Francisco. He looked at me in Spain, and he looked at us, and he said, "I predict you go to San Francisco within a year's time, you and Spain are going to be making $100 a week." Anyway, wow. And plus, I'm on welfare, and you can be on welfare, too. There's nothing to it. And he was right about that. In fact, when I went, my girlfriend was knocked up, and, we went out there. And I swear, if I could have just got along with her better, we had it all sewed up. For what welfare was given us when we were in San Francisco, I could easily, spend my time drawing comics. Wasn't a problem. The rents were good, and it really was this strange period. I mean, we went looking for that golden comic book Valhalla, but the amazing thing was we found it. Except, San Francisco was such a toddling town. Really, it was too rich for my blood. Partying that went on, I had a serious speed habit when I left New York, and I straightened myself out a little bit when I first got to San Francisco, but it wasn't easy because there was, and being an underground cartoonist in San Francisco at that time, I would say it was kind of like being like, a minor league ball player, It was like, we weren't the biggest things in town, but we were big enough so that there was always a party for us, just about any given time, and, plenty of women and, everything that... All that stuff, which is great, I guess, except that, when do you do the work? The way I had it figured out was, I sleep all day and stay up all night and do the work, which was fine, except it was driving my girlfriend nuts, Our relationship was deteriorating badly, for all kinds of different reasons. I mean, it was all great and that, but I'm also lucky to be... still here and doing well, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that I gradually straightened myself out and grew up a little. But that was that took a long time. I don't think I really fully grew up, if I ever did. But I came as close to it until I was about 40 years old. Thank you.
can't you see? See that evening sun go down. Oh, I hate to see. See the evening sun go down. 'Cause my baby, she done gone left this town. And if I'm feeling tomorrow anywhere like I feel today, oh, should I be feeling tomorrow anywhere like I feel today, I'm going to pack my trunk and make my getaway. I'll make my getaway. St. Louis woman with her diamond ring pulls that gal around down by her apron string. Now if it weren't for powder and for store-bought hair, that gal I love, she wouldn't go so far from here. I got the St. Louis blues. I'm just as blue as I can be. Seems like that gal's got a heart like a rock cast in the sea. Or else she wouldn't have gone so far away from me. And I love my baby till the day I die.
As you say in one of your comics, that it takes to a cartoonist, it takes the age 40 to grow up, I believe.
Was that was in the Legal Action.
Yeah.
Denny yeah, that was a fun strip, you know. That was. Yeah, I put a lot of work into that strip. I went down to Ground Zero, took all these photographs and shit. I figured, you know, you have a diatribe strip like that, you got to give them something to look at. So I
just
my butt to, you know, really give a nice pictorama of all this September 11th stuff.
I'll just give people a little background on what we're referring to, the Legal Action Anthology, for our good friend Danny Hellman, who got sued by Ted Rall for a practical joke.
That's a hard strip to read. I really should have done it in four pages, you know. So, you know, it's so teeny tiny.
It's one of your most recent printed strips, isn't it?
It's
just like I've been like kind of delving into your work over the last month, and it's like I think is one of the most recent things that I've come across by you.
Well, I just had a centerfold spread in the Ithaca Film Festival pamphlet. That's probably my most recent strip. But yeah, I guess you're right. You know, like, you know, mostly it's in books and comic books of my stuff. I you know, the only reason those strips exist is because I wanted to help this poor bastard, Danny Hellman, you know. He was in a bad place, and I figured, shit, you know, it could be me one of these times, you know. If we don't stick up for each other, you know.
Who's Ted Rall going to pick next?
Pardon me?
Who's Ted Rall going to pick next?
Well, I don't know, you know. I don't know what he's up to these days, you know. I mean, I'm on speaking terms with the guy. Oh, I see him. I say hi, Ted, and shake hands with him. He's interesting. I mean, you know, part of what was interesting about all that was just studying Ted Rall. You know, is on the human interest level, studying that personality was fascinating to me. I mean, it reminded me of, I don't know if you ever heard of a book called What Makes Sammy Run?
No.
Yeah, well, it was all about this guy in the TV industry who kind of claws his way to the top, this sort of opportunistic, schmucky character. And it's a good book, too. And Jesus, it's just like that book, What Makes Sammy Run? This guy, he's really not one of us. He's just sort of skimming along the top of it and exploiting it for what it's worth until he can find something better to do. And in the meantime, he's only too happy to trash anybody and everybody just to be kind of provocative. I mean, sort of like something like, you know, Walter Winchell or Barry Gray or one of those, you know, columnists of the 40s and 50s. But, you know, as such, very interesting. You know, one of these days, you know, he might make a good story. It'll be interesting to see how the story turns out, you know. And plus, you know, when all that hit the fan, I already knew a lot about him because I have a really good friend named Carol Lay, and she was like pals with him for a while.
That's Justin Green's wife?
No, she's a cartoonist that lives in Los Angeles.
I thought they were together.
A strip called Story Minute.
Oh, I think it's Carol Tyler. Never mind, sorry.
Yeah, no, Carol Lay is somebody else. She's a really good pal of mine. And we're very close, and so, you know, she tells me everything, vice versa, when we get together. And so I already knew a wealth of anecdotal stuff about Ted Rall before any of this business happened. And then when it all happened with, you know, when he wrote this hatchet job piece about Art Spiegelman, I mean, I was one of the people Ted interviewed for the piece. So I knew the piece was bullshit because I knew that, you know, he was making up stuff out of what I said that he couldn't even, you know, some of the things that he wanted to use of mine, but he wanted to twist them around to his own uses. He said this came from an unidentified cartoonist who asked that his name not be used, which is not true at all. I told him a lot of things, and it was all on the record, you know. And so, you know, that was kind of sleazy stuff that I already knew was going on.
What was this hatchet job for? This hatchet job?
It was for the Village Voice, I think.
I want to hear this hot comics gossip here. It was for the Voice?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was for the Village Voice. Ted Rall did a horrible review of Mouse, I think.
It was just basically how Art Spiegelman was the kingpin of the illustration and comics business in New York and kind of was parceled out the jobs, and, you know, he had his bunch of fellows that, you know, he parceled out the jobs to, and Ted Rall was coming to me because he said, and I'll give him credit for this, you know, he said it straight up to me, well, the reason I want to talk to you, Kim, is you are one of those people that I'm talking about. You know, so I give him credit for that, and I say, okay, well, then since we're talking, I'll, you know, let me tell you this and this and this, and I told him a lot of stuff. And I don't know, you know, I didn't know what was going to come of it or anything, but you know what came of it is he did this thing. It was certainly interesting, and you know, Art already, you know, he knew it was coming, and Art just decided, you know, he talked to his wife about it and said, well, look, you know what I'm going to do about this is I'm going to lay low, you know. He did the thing, fine, you know, I've got nothing to say about it, you know, I don't see that there's nothing in it for me to start, you know, tit for tatting with this guy. And so he just basically had nothing to say. And unfortunately, then Danny Hellman, who's always pulling pranks like this with his pals, you know, just sort of stepped in and got everything that Ted was ready to heap on Artie, you know, right between the eyes. You know, basically Danny did
some
really stupid things, but they were sort of funny. But you know, he shouldn't have done it, but he did it, and yeah, it was wrong. And but look, you know, it's just like I said in that strip. Yeah, I mean, you know, it was stupid. But hey, I've done plenty of stupid things and got away with it. And if I got away with it, I'll be goddamned if I'm not going to help this guy get away with it too. Because, you know, why should he be taken down on a caprice from this other guy? You know, it just didn't seem right to me. you know, and you know, God, they both ended up spending a ton of money. You know, the only people that got anything out of it were lawyers.
Yeah.
It was sad.
Nothing ever really ended up happening with it, too, as far as I know. It's pretty much a duck in the water.
The big thing that happened that kind of derailed it was that Ted's lawyer got brain cancer and died.
Oh.
So that, you know, and you know, in some lingering way, it might still be around. I'm not sure. You know, look, you know, Danny gets in trouble again, and he wants to put out legal action number 3. I won't like it, but I will do a strip for 3 in it again. You know, yeah, but I hope it doesn't come to that. You know, I thought it was a sad situation. I mean, the thing that I've always liked about the comic business, and I noticed about it right away, right from when I was a young guy getting into it, is that, you know, and generally speaking, most of the people in it are pretty nice. And when I was first coming up in the business, the old timers that I met, you know, instead of being real high hatters or you know, treating me in distant, condescending ways, were mostly pretty darn nice to me. You know, I got to know Wally Wood.
Wow,
just getting going, and some of these other people, Harvey Kurtzman, and you know, others in the business. And generally speaking, there's pretty nice people there. You know, to the extent that now that I'm at a different place, I try to be the same way when I see up and coming people trying to get into the business. If they got anything going for them, I do my best, you know, not to be a pissant to them. So, you know, to see then this guy kind of candy dancing through it all, it disturbed me, you know.
It takes away from the whole community idea of comics.
I think it does, you know, and which doesn't mean that, you know, I don't have some sympathy for Ted Rawl, too. I mean, you know, on some level, maybe he's got his points. You know, in studying him, I've read a lot of his work, and I think I know where a lot of this anger from him is coming from. And, you know, so I feel some compassion there, too. Boy, I hope he isn't going to sue me when he's free.
Changing the subject, Wally Wood. How did you meet Wally Wood?
Well, I was at a convention in 1968, and one day I met Artie Spiegelman and Roger Brand and Wallace Wood. You know, that was a great day.
That would be a young Art Spiegelman.
Yeah, I think I was about 20 when I first met him, and Wood was like 40, but he was an old 40.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I guess I was like in my early 20s. Wood seemed to me at 40 like a really old guy. He was really had a weather-beaten, downtrodden aspect to him. But he was disarming. He was like unbelievably open and willing to talk about really personal stuff about himself on very brief acquaintance. Hmm. And a really good guy. You know, I didn't know him terribly well, but I knew him a little bit socially. He came over from time to time, and he was a real gentleman. You know, you hear all this stuff about, you know, he was a big drinker and he took drugs and shit like that, and I guess it's true, but I'll tell you this, you know, the whole time I knew him, you know, I drank when I was with him. I smoked dope when I was with him. I never saw him do anything like that. I never saw him indulge in any way, shape, or form himself.
And he did the fabulous Wit's End. That was him, wasn't it?
Pardon me?
The Wit's End anthology,
yes,
which
was... that was a very seminal book, I'll tell you. I was for some odd reason, I was at some newsstand where that was on the newsstand, and I bought it on the newsstand.
Wow.
And, you know, Wit's End, that, it was like, it promised more than it ever delivered, you know, but it just sort of said, now we're going to take comics to a new level. We're going to do things that have never been done before. We're going to expand the medium. You know, the first issue is almost like a manifesto of what we could expect. And I was totally thrilled, you know. And, you know, so full of my own self. I think I'd had like three episodes of Sunshine Girl published at that time. And I immediately sent those off to Wallace Wood. He never answered me. But, you know, I did hear through Are you okay on that?
Yeah, I'm just wondering what the noise is.
Yeah, I'm hearing a lot of stuff.
Just like a couple little blips.
Yeah.
Mm.
Well, I don't know what to say. I'm holding one of these portable phones and walking around the room while I'm talking.
Well, it looks like it stopped. That was odd.
Maybe it's the weather. I bet it's lightning.
Is it hot? Oh, is it lightning there?
It's raining. I bet that's what it is.
It adds some certain amount of tension to the interview.
Yeah. There we go.
I have a question I'd like to ask you, unless you're still talking about wood.
No, it's okay.
I want to ask you about, you worked in a mental institution and you had a revelation on the graveyard shift, I read somewhere.
Yeah, that's right.
But that's all I've read. It didn't go into any detail or anything, and I'm very curious.
Well, I was working in the nut house. The worst floor in the place, too, you know, the real dangerous ones. And so at one point, Nut tried to get away from me. I captured an escaping Nut, which is a great story. I don't know if I should go into that whole story right now, but the offshoot of that was that I got promoted to the night shift, you know, which meant that, you know, all you had to do in the night shift was, you know, you could sit around and read, and as long as you didn't fall asleep, for which you can't, really, you know, it was a pretty easy shift. I mean, the only times it got hairy was like when there was a full moon. Then, you know, the Nuts would act up on the full moon, and occasionally somebody would die on the old folks' ward, and we'd have to go lug the body to the morgue. But outside of that, you know, it was a lot of reading time. So I started, you know, I was reading a lot of poetry, I think. I started reading a lot of the poetry of William Blake. Yeah. That was what happened. You know, and then I read, you know, "To see the world in a grain of sand, in a heaven in a wild flower. Hold infinity in the palm of your hand, and eternity in an hour." And I just suddenly thought, yeah, that's it, you know. If I just start, you know... In art school, what was I trying to do? They were trying to turn me into, you know, a stylist of the accepted modes of art. Mm. You know, if I'd followed in my old man's footsteps, I'd just been like on an animated cartoon assembly line. But that doesn't mean I can't be in art too. It doesn't mean I couldn't do it on my own terms, that I couldn't just work it out of my own head. And on the strength of that, I started painting. And in the midst of the painting, I started being influenced by my brother to look at what was happening in mainstream comic books and work of Winsor McCay, and it all just started to gel. And, you know, really, I'm really still going on that head of steam that I got at that time, which I guess would have been like late in 1965. So that is the answer to your question.
Yeah,
that was great.
Unless you want to follow up and get me to explain something about that.
Well, I mean, you could just the escape leading the. I mean, the promotion is the story leading up to the promotion. You wouldn't elaborate on, but no, that.
Oh, you want to hear the story?
Yeah,
why not?
The story.
I mean, okay. I've got, you know, I got 3 pages more of questions.
It's up to you.
If you're cool with continuing,
I have a lot of questions. So.
Okay.
This is going to be a multi-part epic. So yeah, the story.
You want to hear the story?
Yeah,
okay.
Sure. Let's hear it.
Here it is. All right. There's this a new kid came to Hall A, which is the bad hall that I work on, and for some reason I had to walk this kid through the building to a doctor's appointment. So we were walking along, and there's an open door along one hall, and while I'm sitting there chatting with the kid, suddenly he sees the open door and he takes a run for it. And so I go, holy shit. I'm on the spot here. So, you know, I went tearing out after this kid. And so he goes tearing out around to the front of the nut house. Just as the head of the place is walking out the front door. He's walking out the front door. He's seen this kid tear across his pathway and down a hill. And then I'm come tearing along, and what does he see me do? He sees me. I'm ripping off my white coat so I can navigate myself better, tearing out after this kid. And then, you know, a few minutes later, because, you know, there was a a barbed fence down at the bottom of the hill where the kid was running. He didn't never had a chance, you know. And once I caught up with him, I even said, "Look, now take it easy. You know, I don't like this any more than you. You know, and the only reason I'm doing this is, look, you know, you put me on the spot here." He said, "But, you know, it doesn't have to be as bad as it seems." But, you know, so then we're walking back up, and so the head of the place, he sees me, you know, with my coat still on the street, with this guy in tow. He goes, "Good work, Deitch." You know, and that was like, you know, then suddenly I was a rising star among the nurses' aides. Plus, I graduated the head of my class at nurses' aide class, which they had us all going to for a while. I mean, I was a smart guy. What was I doing in this stupid job? I could explain that, but, you know, it's just one of those things. Well, it was, and I stayed too long, because one thing you realize about the nut house is, after a while, is that
it gets to you.
Illness is catchy, and everybody was screwy in that place, even the kitchen staff.
Mm-hmm. I work in the in that exact field.
Yeah.
In my job that pays, and
so you know
I need breaks.
About.
Oh yeah.
You know, actually, and you know what finally happened is one of the nuts turned me onto the book One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and I read that thing, and you know, and I'm like, holy mackerel, the big nurse. Yeah, we've got, you know, there was somebody who was exactly like her, and all the black boy attendants they were talking about. Christ, those were my friends and associates. you know, what happened is it turned me against the nut house. You know, the last few weeks or months that I was there, I was like sneaking letters out for some of the guys. I, you know, because I'm telling you, the place was really weird. I saw enough weird stuff. It's funny that I've never really drawn on that experience except in the most superficial ways in a couple of times. But, maybe it's because it's just too much of a drag. I mean,
well, there's
I'm
a
trying to divert and entertain here.
In Alias the Cat, you tap that, it seems.
Yeah, you know, there's other little places I've used. There's a strip called Mishkin's Folly, which is
mm-hmm.
Only, you know, I used a factual incident that I'd seen in the Nut House for, you know, my square one for that story. And, you know, you know, I used to like participate in the shock treatments. I saw stuff you wouldn't believe. There's a ton of great material there, but you know, there's a ton of great material everywhere.
It's not the story you want to tell.
Yeah, maybe someday it might work into the right yarn someday. You know, eventually things have a way of getting used. It's funny, like that material is more than 40 years old now. And I don't know. It was, I stayed too long in that place. It got under my skin after a while. I mean, the main reason I stayed so long is there. It was in a time warp. When I walked in there to apply for my job, walking down the hall, I mean, I could have been in the year 1930. And, you know, there was hand-colored pictures on the wall of Bob Jones making that big putt in 1930 and stuff like that, you know. And I was enchanted. Oh my God, I want to work here. This place is magical. Yeah, I guess it was in a way, but you know. I don't know. It was a stupid job, you know. I think it's good that I had that period where I was a working stiff, and that was one of my more colorful jobs I had when that was going on. But, you know, it gave me a chance to get a grip. It gave me a chance to start my life on my own terms, not following in Dad's footsteps or, you know, the art school's footsteps. And in a way, you know, it was kind of incredible how the timing couldn't have been better, because, you know, then when I was really ready to get out and try my wings was the exact moment when comics was about to take off and, you know, an underground newspaper was just like the right thing at the right time.
It's all gotten together nicely. One question I have is, you're talking about the sex rags in New York.
Yeah.
And I know Screw Magazine utilizes a lot of comic artists.
Yeah.
In fact, when I was in New York in October, Danny dragged me up to the Screw office, which is pretty neat to go to.
I guess you met Kevin there. Is it still going? I heard that maybe Screw went belly up again.
Well, at that point it was still going, but I mean, it's not making money off ads much anymore because
yeah.
Everyone's online.
Yeah, I see. Now that everything that goes around comes around. Except, you know, the guy who took over, Kevin, he's a really good guy.
I think he's like the editor right now, right?
Yeah,
he's really neat, and he's really into comics, too.
Yeah, he's a fine fellow.
Did you ever do anything for Screw?
Yeah, I did a cover for them. You know, I didn't do that much for Screw back in the heyday, because when Joel Fabrikant's response to a Screw was, he came out with his own sex bag. You know, he started developing the East Village Other Empire. By the time it was over, he had Kiss Magazine was his version of Screw, and then he had Gay Power, and then he had an astrology magazine called The Aquarian Agent, and then he had the Gothic Blimp Works, which was all comics that I was the editor of, ultimately. So, you know, so any of my sex stuff, generally speaking, you know, it happened in the pages of Kiss Magazine.
No, actually, Gothic Blimp Works, that's referenced as, like, one of the earliest underground just comics.
Yeah. It's kind of like the jumbo comics of underground comics, you know, where, you know, it's the big tabloid mag. I hear they're worth a packet now, you know. I've loaned mine out to some guy. I hope he hasn't skipped out, because subsequently I found out, Christ, those things are going for a ton of money. I have one complete set. That's it. That's all I've got.
What kind of stuff was in those?
Tabloid-sized underground stuff, you know. When I became the editor, I immediately instituted a serial. What was it called? Deja Vu with Waldo. It ultimately ended up in printed in black and white and all Waldo comics. But you know, I did it in color in the Blimp. Since I was the editor, I could farm out the color. And, since I was addicted to speed at the time, I had the patience to be cutting out those manual color separations.
Actually, I have a question about speed once we're done with...
Pardon me?
I have a good question about speed once we're done with this.
Yeah, okay.
Who are some of the people you had in Gothic Blimp Works?
Oh, you know, you name it. Crumb, Wilson, Spain, my girlfriend at the time, Trina, Roger Brand.
Is that Trina Robbins?
Pardon me?
Trina Robbins?
Yeah. You know, and you even have some of the above-ground guys... Bob Stewart, he was started out being my co-editor, but kind of drifted off. Well, basically, at a certain point, Joel Fabrikant wanted me to run it, and I made a private deal with Joel about it, you know, that I didn't even have to show it to the publisher. I mean, he had a secondary person be the publisher, but, you know, my deal with Joel was that the guy who was nominally the publisher didn't get to see it until it was printed, so that was pretty good, you know. But, you know, I couldn't keep up with it, you know, doing my strip for him and editing the Blimp. And plus, you know, I was drinking a lot and taking speed. And, you know, I was just generally kind of a mess. You know, I wasn't ready for all that responsibility. And, you know, being an editor, you know, I'm having a hard time with it even now, doing this book with my two brothers, you know.
Yes, have
to be responsible for other people besides yourself. I don't like it.
Just reining people in.
Yeah, you know, I want to edit books that are drawn and written by me, you know. Even this business with my brothers, you know, once we get this one out, you know, I don't know, I might do another one, but again, I might not.
Do you know who you're going to publish it through, or is it just...
Fantagraphics.
Oh, okay.
It had to be Fantagraphics, because, you know, these guys, they're not used to deadlines like me, you know, and... especially Simon, you know, we did a strip together in Nickelodeon, you know, and when we were doing it together, we never made the deadline once, ever. You know, they would have fired our asses for sure, except the strip we were doing was the hit of the mag.
How many Nickelodeons do you have stuff in? And this is the recent one that has, like, lots of other cartoonists in it?
Yeah, I have no idea. Dozens and dozens of issues.
Oh, wow.
But it's mostly that strip we did together, Southern Fried Fugitives. But, you know, I've done a few things. And it seems like they call me up about once a year for old time's sake. I just did something for them about a month ago. I did a nice one for one of their 3D issues. That was probably my most satisfying strip I ever did for them, because they didn't mess with me that much.
Was that your...
Pardon me?
Is that your first time doing 3D comic?
No, because the guy who did the 3D in that book, an old friend of mine, Ray Zone. So I'd done a few things with him before. In fact, that Toby the Flying Pig that starts out Shadowland, that was originally going to be a 3D story. I drew it
in
3D, yeah. But then Ray decided he didn't want to do it in 3D once I turned it in.
Yeah, that kind of sounds neat with the...
Pardon me?
That sounds interesting with using the pig flying down like that and the 3D idea.
Yeah, yeah. I think, you know, all those pages are drawn to be separated into 3D. That's okay, you know. Hey, it worked out great in Shadowland. It worked out just right in Shadowland.
It's a great way of starting out the book.
Yeah, it's a, you know, that book has been really great. You know, that was sort of, that book seems to be sort of unexpectedly successful, and it's really been extremely useful having it come out so close to Alias the Cat. It's really like a good 1-2 punch.
I'm going to ask a bunch of questions about those two books, but I'm just curious about the effect of speed on your work, because it's one of those things where I find with certain creators, like Kerouac wrote On the Road on a speed binge, but
yeah,
other people...
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me. It did seem speed. It was great, but I can see that could be considered a speedy book.
Yeah, he just sat at the typewriter and had a roll of paper that didn't stop.
Yeah, it was good, too.
But for you, what kind of effect did it have in your work?
It's the kiss of death. It's the quick fix, you know. It gives you something great today, but, you know, it tears you down for tomorrow. It's such a bad idea, it isn't even funny. That's what I think of it, you know. Maybe it's something, you know, it seems like just about everybody I know went through a speed phase. I guess since I'm a more addictive personality than most, you know, I got good and hooked on it. And I thought I was through. You know, I rode out to California with Gilbert Shelton at the end of 69, and I kind of kicked on the ride out. And that was amazing to sort of wake up and, you know, think, hey, you know, I think that's off of me. You know, I felt kind of renewed at first. But then, you know, there was pills all over San Francisco. You know, I started taking it in a whole other way. I wasn't taking it while I was working, but, you know, I'd go to parties, we'd get smashed, and we'd take speed, and then so we could drink some more, you know. And you could almost do a good imitation of being not drunk by taking speed, except that you really weren't, you know.
Then you got other stuff coming in other than being drunk.
You know, I'm one of the luckiest guy that ever lived. You know, I got through a lot of this stuff, and I'm still here. I'm still in good health. I feel very blessed. You know, that somehow, you know, it's like something was watching over me all that time. And somehow I had all these things happen to me as rites of passage. Somehow, I had the good fortune to see them for what they were ultimately and get them off my back.
I find it really interesting that you're so honest about addiction's history, because some people kind of see that as like something to be forgotten about in time, and it's like you look at that as kind of a point of building who you are today.
Well, you know, it's a two-edged sword. I mean, that same addictive personality, you can turn that around and get addicted to work. You know, you can get addicted to you know, good habits too, and I think, you know, in a way, it's that same generating motor, you know, harnessed to good things. That's sort of what's got me going good now.
Now,
it's a compulsiveness, is what it is.
that one-track mind of mine, it can't understand that you don't care. Just to change the mood I'm in, I'd welcome a nice old